the kind of abuse of power and censoring of media that Senator Hontiveros described in the Philippines doesn't happen overnight. We're seeing a slightly lower level of intimidation here in the United States. It's just as threatening to the state of our democracy. With the compression of newspapers and broadcast stations and very little independence among them, the independent journalists who are still working in the U.S. are also being characterized as enemies. But so far, we have no proof of the kind of criminal intimidation that Senator Hontiveros and journalists in the Philippines are reporting. So it's becoming a worldwide form of intimidation. We're honored to welcome to this call a longtime activist and watchdog for independent media, Lisa Graves, who began her career as the Deputy Attorney General in the United States Department of Justice during the Clinton administration. She served as the Chief Counsel for Nominations of the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee under Vermont Senator Patrick Leahy and worked as the Senior Legislative Strategist on national security issues for the American Civil Liberties Union, and has also been an adjunct professor at George Washington University Law School. Lisa led the Progressive Watchdog Group Center for Media and Democracy starting in 2009, where she investigated and reported on the Koch brothers, the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, and the State Policy Network. In 2012, Lisa was interviewed about the Center for Media and Democracy project, ALEC Exposed, for the Bill Moyers documentary film, United States of ALEC. And in 2016, Graves was interviewed in Ava DuVernay's documentary, 13th. Currently, Lisa directs True North Research and the DocumentedInvestigations.org group, a watchdog group that investigates how corporations manipulate public policy, harming our environment, communities, and democracy. Lisa, how worried should Americans be about the state of corporate-controlled information and an administration that labels independent journalism who criticize this president's policies as the enemy?
Well, that's a great question, Mary Beth, and I want to thank you so much for that that kind introduction and the promotion from a counsel coming in at the Justice Department to ultimately becoming Deputy Assistant Attorney General where I was at, when I was at DOJ. But on the question of how worried people should be, I don't mean for the lightness in my voice to mean that we should take that lightly at all. I think that we are actually at a extraordinarily fragile point in the health of our democracy. I think that when you look at the array of things that have been happening with this administration, you know, not that other administrations were perfect by any means, but this is a whole different order, not just magnitude. I know that that the activists on this call have followed closely some of the movement over the years by the Bush administration and by the Obama administration in terms of leaks involving national security issues and how both Democratic and Republican administrations were treating the press in those circumstances, and the reality that we don't have an active, real press shield law in the United States to protect reporters. But I think what you're seeing, obviously, now with Trump is an overt, active hostility to the press that we've seen it with our own eyes. And I guess, Mary Beth, I just want to ask you whether I should we should do this as a Q&A or whether I should just speak for a little while about it.
Why don't you speak for a little while? We will have a Q&A, though. Our members are hopefully thinking of questions right now, and they can start even now pressing number one on their phone keypads if they as questions come up in their mind, and then we'll do
okay.
A stack afterwards.
Okay. Well, so, you know, I think that I guess I wanted to just review the lay of the land on a couple of different pieces of this, and I would begin by just, I suppose, emphasizing that there's a lot of talk about the rule of law, and certainly vogue for Republicans to claim adherence to the rule of law. They often run on it. They claim to appoint judges based on it. At the Koch soiree, where Charles Koch brought together his billionaires last year, he actually just had their retreat for the billionaires this last weekend. But at the previous one, he claimed that his focus on trying to move the Supreme Court was grounded in the, quote, rule of law. You can sometimes see that in campaign speeches by politicians. It's a phrase that people, particularly on the right, have tended to use. And yet we see now when, you know, sort of push comes to shove, when the lights are on, how little respect there is for the rule of law by many of those people, whether they're people like Charles Koch, I would say, or others. They have stood by in mostly silence in response to an array of attacks by this president on the press and on democratic norms. Shortly after the election in 2016, I was asked about the rule of law by NPR. And at that time, a bit of trepidation about what was to come, I said that the rule of law is fragile. And even in a democracy like the United States, it really depends on the people in positions of power being willing to follow those rules and follow them scrupulously. If I were to amend that observation today, I would say it also obviously depends on judges willing to enforce the law and insist that the law be followed. We're witnessing a constitutional crisis involving the census and a president determined to, in essence, overrule a decision by the U.S. Supreme Court, a rare decision, in essence, against him, given and against his party, given what the court did right before that in terms of its decision to abdicate the field and take away basically federal power to correct the extreme partisan districting or redistricting that we've seen that has utterly distorted our democracy. You have a court, to refer back to the Citizens United decision, which has begun to impose an extremely regressive structural change to our Constitution, to the way of life in our democracy. But it did stand up to Trump on this one issue regarding the census, in part because the evidence was so clear of what they were trying to do. And the census in our Constitution does not require it to be a census of citizens versus people. And you can see his defiance over that rare rebuke, in essence, his determination to go forward regardless of that. That's just in one area. We saw that in the area of immigration at the beginning of the administration. We've seen the recalcitrance, the lies, the deceit going on in the absolute humanitarian crisis that this administration has created at our borders, in the shocking and outlandish, horrifying separation of families. And so this administration is making its own rules on a host of things. And this president has made a whole new, basically, game plan for dealing with the press in this country. I actually wondered out loud, and I'll say it here to you all, I certainly don't think this president has read the Constitution that he's taken an oath sworn to uphold. I actually doubt that he's actually read the few words in the First Amendment. Certainly not from his behavior would you think that he has read it or believes that he has any duty, moral duty or legal duty, to uphold it. That Constitution, as you know, our Constitution provides, you know, express protection for the freedom of the press. And yet we have a president who has regularly and routinely called for dramatic changes to the law and practice regarding journalists, to name several. He has repeatedly threatened to change or somehow unilaterally change libel laws to make it easier to sue people who criticize him. He's threatened legal action against journalists who have been critical of him. He's routinely attacked mainstream corporate news sites like the CNN and the Washington Post. He's threatened to sue a number of those outlets, even when they made a retraction due to an innocent error. He has talked about the press in extremely disdainful ways, calling them disgusting. You know, he's threatened to cancel the licenses of the FCC licenses of media companies that offer negative statements about him. He has praised he praised one of the political candidates, Greg Gianforte, when he attacked a reporter. He routinely goads the crowds at his sort of ego fest rallies into chanting at the press in, you know, extremely hostile ways. And we have a president who has contempt for the freedom of the press. And then I think I would be remiss if I didn't talk about the case of Jamal Khashoggi. I'm sure that your membership heard with horror the release this past month of the tapes about the premeditated murder of Jamal Khashoggi, who was a journalist for the Washington Post. He was a columnist for an American paper. He'd been living in the United States. He's a former editor-in-chief of a news channel, of an Al Arab news channel, and he was murdered. But there's just no doubt about it. At first, this president claimed he was going to take the Saudi leadership at its word, that they had nothing to do with it. And then when evidence emerged almost immediately, and then more so subsequently, making it quite clear what happened and the role of the Saudi leadership, the president has brushed off, you know, any calls for further investigation and has affirmatively said that America stands with Saudi Arabia, in part based on the arms sales that he, Trump, has been facilitating with the aid, I suppose would be one way to describe it, of his son-in-law, who's quite frankly not qualified for virtually any job, let alone the job he holds at the White House. And so you have a situation in which there are gruesome details about that murder of a journalist who had been working for an American outlet. Not that it would make any difference in terms of the murder of journalists worldwide, but in this instance, any other president would have condemned that murder. Instead, you have a president who has, as recently as a week ago, talked about how he stands by Saudi Arabia in spite of that. I remember a time in the United States when, and it's still, I suppose, the case, although it means even less today, but I remember a time when the United States actually at least acted as a leader in defense of the freedom of the press worldwide and in the United States, and that the United States press law and press protections in general were seen as a model for other countries. And the United States Department of State issues an annual report about the state of press freedom in other countries. It's hard to imagine the United States having any moral authority in that arena with this president and his statements and his actions. But it's not just this president. We've seen a rise in the tendency of police to try to arrest reporters, to take away cameras from reporters, to try to physically limit access to protests and to dissent, places of dissent and movements of dissent by reporters. I know many of you saw and heard how Amy Goodman was treated in North Dakota, where they issued a warrant for arrest. Ultimately, a judge threw out the charges against her, but it was extraordinary, and it's not the only case in the United States of journalists being threatened for covering the news. But beyond those journalists, we're also seeing a movement that is based in part, and a movement I suppose is in some ways the wrong word because it's really a concerted effort by the lawmakers who are part of ALEC and the Republican Party in states to dramatically criminalize protests around pipelines, to take what would be perhaps a trespassing charge, a minor charge for people who have the courage to stand and protest at a pipeline site, and try to turn it into a felony with a jail sentence of multiple years. In fact, to come full circle to the beginning of my remarks, one of the things that's happened in the United States and on an accelerated basis in the past decade almost is that the idea of corporate speech or the free speech of corporations, the free speech, the supposed free speech rights of these dark, murky nonprofit groups, these dark money groups, is glorified and considered to basically be sacred by the Supreme Court. And meanwhile, actual human beings speaking is not protected. And in fact, the right of actual dissent and speech by ordinary people has been limited at a time that the courts, the United States Supreme Court in particular, has been elevating the rights of corporations. That corporations have somehow religious rights that trump the rights of actual human women who work for those companies, as is the case in the attacks on the Affordable Care Act. The idea that corporations have rights to, quote, speak in our elections through these nonprofit groups without disclosing their donors, but our rights as voters are curtailed by this court, whether it's the limitations to the Voting Rights Act or the recent decision to, as I said, make the courts leave the field for correcting for the extreme partisan district redistricting we've seen, the gerrymandering that basically allows politicians to choose their voters rather than the voters to choose who represents them in our democracy. And so I would say to you, I suppose, in conclusion, that I think our democracy is at tremendous peril. I suppose I should be grateful, and I am grateful, that we have not seen the kind of violence that has been instigated by Duterte in the Philippines. I'm certainly grateful for that. But I also, you know, am very concerned about sort of trends, this trend toward the acceptability, in essence, of violence toward reporters, or the sort of goading of crowds toward that, but also trends toward an acceptance or even, you know, active support for a president with obvious authoritarian tendencies, dictatorial tendencies. You know, our democracy in some ways is very young. And in fact, the experiment of democracy after that experiment in Greece centuries ago, the more recent experiment, the experiment in the era of the Enlightenment is actually very recent. And yet the fundamental principles of the Enlightenment that helped bring forth the notion of a modern democracy are being assailed. One of the fundamental components of the Enlightenment of that period was the idea of being people based on science, based on principles, based on facts. And that entire foundation for having a healthy democracy, that there would be representatives who would make policy to serve the interests of their constituents based on facts, based on finding out the best solutions to problems, has been, in essence, thrown out the window. And it's happened at a time when, as you point out, Mary Beth, there's been a lot of consolidation in media, and there's been a lot of difficulties for local press and for alternative press to keep the lights on with some of the changes in our economy and the way people get information. And at the same time, I'm extremely, and I want to end on a positive note, genuinely, I'm extremely hopeful. Because I feel like there's more great investigative journalism going on in this country than there has been in decades. There's a greater, deeper commitment by a number of corporate and not corporate news outlets to uncovering the truth and exposing the truth and getting the word out to awaken people. There's a growing number of Americans who have woken up to the state of our democracy and to the threats that we face from this erosion of these democratic principles and these norms, especially in this period we're in as a matter of sort of geologic time, which is this dramatic, these dramatic changes that are happening to our climate, the climate of our planet, the devastating climate changes that are underway. And so I think you have an awakening happening among young people about the importance, for example, of addressing climate and of the necessity of our democracy to be able to do so. And I think you have a resurgence in the forcefulness, the assertiveness of the press in reporting on these issues and covering these issues and investigating corruption and uncovering it. And so I'm very hopeful, but I do fear that given the behavior we've seen by Trump in these last 2.5 years in terms of his contempt for the law, for the Constitution, for basic norms in our democratic system, if he were reelected, I wonder what constraints there would be that he would adhere to at all, and whether the courts, given how many judges he's packed into the courts with the help of Mitch McConnell, judges who appear to have been screened in part by Leonard Leo for their support for this structural revolution, this structural, quote, revival of limited power of the courts, whether the courts would stand up to this president the way prior courts have stood up to presidents who have transcended and exceeded the rules, as with President Nixon. Certainly the political parties in Washington are not doing all that can be done to hold this president accountable for his actions and for the evidence that's been provided about his criminal activity, in my view. But I am hopeful that there's a rising tide of Americans of all ages who have been seeing what's happening and are determined to set a different course. And I guess I would say that in my personal capacity, as I speak to you, I'm very hopeful that America will reject this president and reject this path at the next possible opportunity in about 18 months from now.
Thanks for that presentation, Lisa. It was pretty much what many of us hoped to hear, and yet feared to hear at the same time. We do have some questions. Barbara Taft, you had your hand up. Is it still up? Your mic is open.
Okay. Yeah, it's been up and it's been down. But yes, I do have a question. Based on your background in the Department of Justice, Lisa, what is your opinion about the fact that since this president seems to want to rule by fiat and be accountable to no one, if that violates the law of the land, the Constitution, could that be an impeachable offense?
Well, that's a great question, Barbara. You know, it certainly was in the impeachment articles of President Nixon. One of them was about this sort of question, about this contempt for the rule of law, this not taking care to execute our laws. I'm actually searching for the exact language that was used, but it's certainly possible. I personally think that the United States House of Representatives needs to pursue this issue assertively. I think they need to have hearings, but hearings that are not impeachment hearings, you know, may not be enough. I know that there's this sort of idea out there of doing this longer hearings and then into a potential impeachment proceeding. And there's some people who are in leadership it seems, who, you know, are concerned about that path, in part because there's no way the United States Senate will do anything, anything to address impeachment or the evidence of the crimes that Mr. Mueller and his team outlined in his report. But I don't think the House should defer to the Senate in that way. I think that the House has a moral duty to conduct a thorough investigation, its own investigation, to demand and insist on all of the materials that were used and created by Robert Mueller and his team, and to issue a finding about that and vote on it. I think they have a moral duty to do so. I say that even though I have no hope that the Senate will engage this in any moral fashion with the utterly immoral and, in essence, in my view, failed leadership of Mitch McConnell in the Senate, given how much he has proven his willingness to do the bidding of this president and the bidding of the corporations and dark money groups that basically he's in league with. But I think that I think this question of a president not following the rule of law, you know, being contemptuous of the rule of law, is a potential basis. And now I've actually found the language. One of the articles of impeachment talked about how the president has sought to, this is the obstruction charge, sought to delay or impede or obstruct the investigation, in that case, in the Watergate break-in. And they've also, one of the other articles of impeachment was about the president violating the constitutional rights of people, impairing the due and proper administration of justice, contravening laws governing agencies. And then there was a failure to comply with the subpoenas. So, from my perspective, based on the evidence that's already out there, there's ample ground to begin an impeachment proceeding. And I just hope that Congress ultimately will. I think that it has a duty to do so. That's just my personal view.
Okay, thank you. Our next question is with Nancy Price, and I want to remind everybody, if you have a question, you can press number one on your phone keypad. Go ahead, Nancy.
Hi, Lisa. Thank you for such a great presentation. I've been so interested to watch both the print media and the TV radio media about how much there are so many young, new writers, reporters, investigative reporters of many different backgrounds, representing many different ethnicities and quite young, coming out of different schools of journalism. So I find that very, very encouraging, and I just wondered if you were finding the same. Thanks.
Lisa?
Can you hear me? Sorry about that. I want to thank you, Nancy, for that question. It's so nice to hear your voice.
Nice to hear yours.
I'm really happy to see how media, in essence, has diversified over the past 20 or 30 years. In particular, it seems like over the past 10 years, to see so many different perspectives, different backgrounds of people in the news, on the news. It really does have a greater reflection of the beautiful diversity, the mosaic of our society. And yet, you know, it is the case that I think that there are there's still a not sufficient coverage of peace issues, not sufficient coverage of nuclear disarmament and the threat, the real threats that obviously remain with the nuclear stockholds around the world. Even with the saber rattling between this president and North Korea, despite the recent little love fest, there's not enough coverage, I think critical coverage of that, the enormity of the Pentagon budget, And there's certainly not enough, I think, critical coverage of, you know, issues, economic issues from the standpoint of poverty and opportunity. There's more coverage now of, you know, issues like raising minimum wage and the fact that the minimum wage has not been raised for so long. It's outlandish. But there has not, you know, there has not been a sort of full transformation in having the media reflect more broadly some of the issues that are perceived as, quote, left issues, whether they're issues of peace and pacifism and nuclear disarmament, whether they're issues of, you know, the proper and serious critique that needs to be leveled at the utterly disproportionate spending on the Pentagon and not just, you know, reporting on waste, which is obviously, you know, an issue, but just the magnitude of that spending and what it displaces. And I think AOC, you know, the congresswoman from New York, has really started to open up that conversation, and that has garnered press coverage, you know, when they say, how is she going to pay for the Green New Deal? And she says, how are we paying for everything we're paying for right now? And I feel really appreciative, deeply appreciative of her comments on these issues. She did a great video about climate. You can search it on YouTube. It's fantastic. And she, you know, is really speaking truth in a very clear way about issues that have not been talked about. And I think that has to be in part from her background as a woman of color, as a woman who worked as a waitress. I worked as a waitress myself. When I first started working again on minimum wage issues a couple of years ago, I was astonished that the minimum wage for tipped workers was, I think, less than a dime more than it was when I was waiting tables in 1990 before law school, which was $2.13 an hour. I think now it's $2.20 an hour. Just to take a little diversion here for a second, I had been looking at who was opposing these minimum wage policies, and I discovered that the International Hotel and Lodging Association was one of the big opponents. And I looked into it, and I thought, this is amazing. These minimum wage laws, the subminimum wage, in essence, for tip workers, isn't just, you know, applying to a waiter at a fancy French restaurant. It applies to hotel maids and wait staff at conventions and wait staff, you know, at any establishment across the country. The people who are in a tipped position are paid a minimum wage of $2 and less than a quarter an hour, which, you know, if you just do the math, that's, you know, for an 8-hour day, that's less than 20, basically $20 or $100 a week, plus whatever tips they manage to get from people who leave a buck in their hotel room or from people who might tip a dollar or two for a burger. And it is not a living wage by any means. But the baseline minimum wage, I think we're at $7 or $8 per hour, depending on the state. That's not a living wage either, given the cost of living for people. And so I know that was a little bit of a move away from what we were talking about. But because you have someone in Congress like AOC who has recently held that job, isn't a millionaire, didn't come from this class of billionaires, didn't get to Congress because of billionaires backing her in particular. You know, she brings a voice to our public debate that has been missing and that is necessary for us to have a healthier democracy. And I believe, although I haven't been in those newsrooms across the country, that having other voices of women from all backgrounds, people of color, people who are immigrants or children of immigrants, speaking up, sharing their perspective, has got to make our news better, as it makes our democracy better, as it makes our society better.
Thanks for that answer. It was very stirring, and we wanted to hear about it. The next question comes from Ricky Gard Diamond, the author of Spoonomics.
Hello. I almost want to withdraw my question because that last talk about was so inspiring. Thank you, Lisa. We do need that kind of hopeful talk, and It's why I think women's talking about a realm that has usually been a man's world, namely economics, including the macroeconomics, is really important. But I just wanted to comment that I thought that, you know, you've been talking about what we've all seen, an erosion of law in our country that is frightening. But I noticed that the senator earlier used the term weaponizing the law. And it seems now that we have just gone into this new stage with a whole party of a whole political party seeming to go along with that. And we all know that corruption has something to do with that. But it was particularly chilling just today to see the Attorney General really stand up and praise the president, almost like a dear leader moment, you know, for what he was doing with this citizen question, which is just so chilling. And so can you give us some hope about that, or some direction of people who are really looking closely at this this devolution of law, this weaponization of law by people who are essentially very corrupt and only want to win however they can do it?
Well, that's a wonderful and horrifying question. I saw that myself, Ricky. Thank you so much. You know, there's just no doubt in my mind that Bill Barr has no business being the Attorney General of the United States. He is not treating that office as a steward of the role of the Justice Department. It's certainly not the role of the modern Justice Department in being independent of this president. He literally treats it and behaves like a lapdog to this president, as if he's the personal lawyer to this president, which he's not, and which the United States Department of Justice is not. And even the White House counsel is not actually the personal lawyer of this president. The White House counsel is supposed to be the counsel, you know, to the White House, to the administration. But when you see Bill Barr speak and act so subserviently, you know, it demeans the office that he holds. And I think that, you know, that's precisely why he was chosen, because he was going to be an enabler to Trump at every turn. And that he would not even follow through on his recusal from the Epstein case, which, you know, has brought its own set of sort of horrifying revelations about Epstein, but also about the role of Alex Acosta, who's the Secretary of the Department of Labor, and who basically was put into that U.S. attorney role as a very young man by President Bush. A job that he certainly was not suited for, and he has refused to apologize for the abjectly immoral deal that he cut, the secret deal that he cut with Epstein, someone who has raped children, women, children, you know, underage women, but who has raped people. You know, it's astonishing. I want to, in a positive note, but before I get there, if you haven't read Rebecca Solnit's article this week, it's called "In Patriarchy, No One Can Hear You Scream." If you search for Rebecca Solnit, you just do a search for this past week. It's on lithub.com, and she talks about this question of you know, how the law has aided and how the culture has aided this real culture of rape, and she walks through a number of examples of the men who have been helpers in this normalization. You know, she talks about Ken Starr's record when he was at a university in terms of turning a blind eye. She talks about Alan Dershowitz's record and more and more. It goes on at length, but it's actually the core of that, the beginning of that piece is about the rule of law. It's about whether you have might is right, or Mike makes right, or whether you have justice. And that actually, in some ways, is the question we face, which is this question of whether we are going to be a nation of the Enlightenment, whether we're going to be a nation that protects these democratic principles, the core principle of which is equal justice under law, that no man or woman is above the law and no man or woman is beneath the law, and that it mm-hmm. cannot be dispensed in these ways that we've seen it so unjustly dispensed with the, you know, certainly the examples that Ava DuVernay documented at length in her film, The 13th, in terms of how the criminal law has been used as a weapon against Black Americans for more than a century in this country in a variety of ways. But when you look at this question of, are we going to be a nation of laws or of men? And in the case of her essay, you know, she talks specifically of men and how the media and how the culture had, you know, had enabled these things that have gone on. I think that you can see what a crisis point we're at in that area as well, which is this nation is not acting consistent with the promises that I would say the Constitution provides. It's failing those promises, and the law has in fact been weaponized against a number of people in a number of ways over our history. And yet, I believe that there was sort of a golden during the 50s, 60s, 70s, in which the United States Supreme Court, with Earl Warren at its helm, actually breathed life into the promises of the Constitution and insisted that its plain language be enforced, whether it was equal protection of law in Brown v. Board of Education, to say that separate but unequal is unacceptable and unconstitutional, or whether it was the statement that when the Constitution says that a person has a right to counsel, that means they actually have a right to counsel in the Gideon case, and more. But what we've seen in response to those rulings has been a right-wing movement that has sought to reverse those decisions. And along with that, we've seen a right-wing movement that has been determined through the power of wealth, the power of might, in essence, might makes right, to overturn the New Deal and basically all of the positive attributes of our modern democracy, whether that's public schools and public education, whether it's rules that govern our elections, as with campaign finance rules that were overturned summarily in Citizens United, and more. And some of that has been fomented by Charles Koch and by his billionaire buddies and other very wealthy families that have sought to basically take back the gains of these movements, the civil rights movement, the environmental movement, the peace movement, and the gains by independent judges who are actually enforcing the plain terms of the Constitution for the first time in almost its history, starting in the 1950s, at least with respect to individual rights of ordinary people in this country, Black Americans, women, and more. And so the law is being weaponized, and the Citizens United States, the Citizens United case is a key example of that, where that law, basically to interpret the First Amendment that way, basically makes the First Amendment into a weapon by the wealthy against the rest of us to almost dictate, although not entirely dictate, but to dramatically distort the results of our elections. And it's a true crisis in our democracy. And the dark money story the Washington Post published in May about Leonard Leo and the dark money surrounding the appointments of the United States Supreme Court was an extraordinary story that I would hope everyone gets a chance to read about how that dark money is not just distorting our elections, but also distorting who gets on our U.S. Supreme Court. We have an array of constitutional crises in this country. The press is one of them. The courts is another.
Thank you so much, Lisa. We've gone over the time, but I hope that people found your presentation as riveting as I did. I guess the one thing I would ask is what is there that people like us, Wolf members, can do to support independent journalists?
Well, I do think it's helpful to write letters when there's great journalism, to subscribe to great journalism. I think it's also helpful to respond when journalists are attacked, to condemn those attacks. I think that there's more we can do in general in our democracy to get more people registered to vote and talk to people more and more about these issues from our heart, about why it matters and what's at stake for our future, which I know I'm certain that your members do on a regular basis.
We do. We're pretty good about that. Michael has one quick question he's insisting to ask, so let's go ahead, Michael.
Hi, Lisa. Earlier in the call, you mentioned about the rule of law, and we all know about, you know, the dog whistling with phrases like law and order and states' rights, and you had just alluded to kind of AOC and some of the things that have gone on with her. I know recently with the her and the other congressperson down at the border, you know, the Facebook group where they were, you know, saying $10,000 to throw a burrito, someone throws a burrito at them, and then the images that were kind of being put forward. And then they go around after her visit when she says that they announced about the toilets, kind of the hypocrisy there about them saying they felt threatened by her. And then how the media cycle picks that up. I was just hoping if you could speak a little bit just to, you know, the terminologies, like you mentioned, the rule of law and the hypocrisy with the those in power right now and the echo chamber that is the media, and just that role, because it seems quite dangerous how that those groups are kind of just almost like a tribal mentality, kind of following that, oh, AOC was threatening the gods and this and that. And that kind of all plays in to racial issues, whether it's the immigrants, AOC being a person of color, and then, you know, phrases like those dog whistle phrases. If you could speak more to that, please, and thank you. Check.
Well, there certainly is a tremendous amount of tribalism, although I've struggled with to find an alternative word to describe it. But what you have this sort of idea of there is a team, and it doesn't matter if your team cheats, you're not going to leave that team because that team is your champion, or that Trump, for example, is defending your race, is what it sort of the implication is from all of his praising of the white supremacists and the Nazis and more. And so I think that's very dangerous. It's dangerous for a lot of reasons, one of which is that it empowers other people to basically act out on those impulses that they may have believed were socially unacceptable before in terms of being and saying racist things in that way. And those emails from the Border Patrol were simply appalling, or the Facebook group sort of correspondence, I guess it wasn't emails, but the racism in there was just horrible to see. And it has been sort of awakened and fueled and fed in part by the legitimacy that this president attempts to give it. I think it remains illegitimate. I think that we're going to ultimately change course and look back on this period as dark days that we're glad are over. But we have a rising of people who seem to feel that they're empowered to attack people based on the color of their skin, or to question their immigration status, or to otherwise put them down in ways that, you know, were not socially acceptable to do openly, at least in recent prior years. And so that too is an enormous challenge for us to rebuild our society, or to build it to be a better society that has more genuine respect for other human beings, no matter their race or gender or sexual orientation or religion. That we could have a society that more closely meets the aspirations of our nation.
From your lips to God's ear, Alicia. Lisa has been a friend of the Corporations versus Democracy Committee and of Wolf generally for about a decade. We want to thank you very much for being with us tonight, Lisa.
Thank you so much for having me on. I'm sorry I was a little long-winded. It was an honor to be on this call, particularly with the brave senator from the Philippines, and to hear your voices and to hear your questions. And if I can help in any way, in my personal capacity, just say the word. Mary Beth knows how to reach me.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.